prepare yourself for an adventure like no other.
Hello, everyone, and welcome aboard the Walt Disney World Transportation System. We're on our way to Disney's Animal Kingdom.
Gosh, this is some crowd! Hi there! Did you get a guide map? You don't want to miss any of the sights on your adventure here at Disney's Animal Kingdom. Oh, be sure and take some photos of the wildlife in the park today. You know, so you can share them with your friends back home.
Not a zoo.
Not a zoo.
Disney's Animal Kingdom, it's many things, but there's one thing it's not. Not a zoo!
WDW Radio, your information station.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World information station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 481. And I'm here once again, not only to help you have the best possible vacation experience when you come to the Disney parks, but I also want to bring you a little bit of Disney magic with the podcast, videos, blog, live broadcasts every Wednesday night on Facebook, my books, audio tours, and more. You can find everything over at wdwradio.com. So long before anyone ever dreamed of Pandora, the world of Avatar, or even Camp Minnie Mickey at Disney's Animal Kingdom, original plans for Walt Disney World's fourth theme park included an exciting, radical new concept. This kingdom of animals was going to include not only those that were real, but ones that were ancient and imagined. A kingdom to be ruled by lions, dinosaurs, and dragons. So this week, we're going to turn back the clock on our Walt Disney World Wayback Machine and explore this land that never came to be, Beastly Kingdom. We discuss how and why this land of mythical beasts got on the drawing board, virtually tour the attractions and environments, look at why it never came to be, why we'll likely never see any of it at all, and where you can still find remnants of it in the park today. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week, and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. Then stay tuned to the end of the show for more information, some announcements, including upcoming WDW Radio events and meets of the month in Walt Disney World and Disneyland, your voicemails, and more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. In 2011, when Disney announced that an entirely new land dedicated to James Cameron's Avatar film was coming to Disney's Animal Kingdom, the internet, well, had a lot to say. Some cheered, some jeered, some laughed, some questioned, and some even lamented what they, deep down, knew meant the loss of what might have been, because the announcement of this new land almost surely killed off the possibility of another. But why were some people so upset? Because since the opening of Disney's Animal Kingdom in 1998, we were given clues and hints, some subtle, some not, of what might have been. From the parking lot to the original logo and even McDonald's Happy Meal toys, we were teased about what was going to be built on the land originally occupied by what would eventually become Camp Minnie Mickey. And from day one, even before the grand opening, this park was going to be known as a kingdom of animals. Real, ancient, and imagined. A kingdom ruled by lions, dinosaurs, and dragons. And before the park opened in 1998, Disney Imagineers were certain the park would one day house those imaginary creatures in a land to be known as Beastly Kingdom. But that phase two never came to be, and with the opening of Pandora coming up soon, it looks like it probably never will be. But this week, we want to take a look at what Beastly Kingdom was supposed to be, what kind of attractions and experience we would have seen, why it never got off the drawing board, and what and where we can still find some reminders of what might have been. And joining me this week is a man who is like many of the creatures which would have occupied Beastly Kingdom. He is mysterious, he is mythical, and only a select few have ever seen his hidden lair. He is author, friend, raconteur, and historian, Mr. Jim Korkus.
Well, thank you so much, Lou. Yeah, yes, very I think we're both very beastly. So this gives us a unique perspective in terms of talking about this. And for those listeners who may not know Beastly Kingdom and why there's so much of an uproar about, you know, why this is not being built, you need to understand there's a significant difference between Beastly Kingdom and Pandora. In Beastly Kingdom, guests would have crossed over a bridge to get to a land where they could have taken a leisurely boat ride through strange but beautiful scenery with imaginary creatures. And then they would go and strap themselves into a ride that would have them flying and encountering a dragon. Whereas in Pandora, it's completely different. Guests cross over a bridge to get to a land where they can enjoy a leisurely boat ride through strange but beautiful scenery featuring imaginary creatures, and then strap themselves into a ride where they fly through the air encountering something that looks like a dragon. So it's completely different. So we can understand why people are so upset that they're not getting, you know, what they expected.
Well, it goes to prove, right, that no good idea at Disney ever really dies. It might get shelved and dusted off and brought back in somewhat of a slightly different way. But let's go back.
Well, because I'm curious, because Joe Rohde is involved with both concepts. I'm wondering how much input he had of, hey, you know, Jim Cameron, it would be a great idea, you know, if we had this boat ride.
You know, but it's interesting, Jim, because it really does, you know, go back to, and we were talking offline before we started recording about the early days and how many people might even remember the discussion of Beastly Kingdom, let alone not a zoo, because when they originally discussed the concept of what Animal Kingdom was going to be, they said it's going to be based on three things. It's going to be based on animals, but they're real, the extinct, and the imaginary. So we have the real. We've got all these attractions that showcase them in the safari, at the shows. We have the extinct animals in an entire land devoted to dinosaurs. But these imaginary, these mythical creatures like dragons and unicorns and sea monsters, we're going to go in this land that was going to be known as Beastly Kingdom. And sometimes Beastly Kingdom was spelled somewhat differently with lots of M's and I's and E's. But it was going to be these legendary animals that didn't exist. They were going to take these fairy tales that came out of storybooks and bring them into this land that, like, you know, all good Disney fairy tales, was going to be about stories of good and evil.
And ironically, when Disney announced this and they were doing surveys of people, because Disney do lots and lots of surveys, ironically, people said the thing that they're most excited about going to Animal Kingdom would be to see Beastly Kingdom and these mythological creatures. This is what was driving that. And at the time, I was the representative for the Walt Disney Travel Company. So they sent me out to three different cities a week for 10 weeks, where I was talking to groups of travel agents in Dallas and Washington, D.C., and all of this. And one of the things that was being promoted was Animal Kingdom. And the audience was just enthralled. They couldn't wait, you know, to see this. This was the key thing. Because, of course, building Animal Kingdom was Eisner's way of trying to compete with Busch Gardens in Tampa that had live animal interaction and had roller coaster thrill rides. And that was Eisner's, of course, philosophy. Iger's philosophy is, let's buy franchises. Let's buy Star Wars. Let's buy Marvel. Let's buy the Muppets. Eisner's was, let's take a look at what other people are doing out there, and Disney is going to do it better. So Church Street Station in downtown Orlando, with all these themed restaurants and shops and all this is great. We're going to build Pleasure Island. and Wet n Wild, that's so popular, we're going to do Typhoon Lagoon. And so the same thing with this is that Busch Gardens in Tampa, you know, that's drawing guests away. Let's, you know, have our own wild kingdom here and keep money on Disney property, and we can do it better. And the way they were going to plus it, which is that Disney term, is you're not just going to have the live animals. You're not just going to have roller coasters. You're going to have the dinosaurs. You're going to have, you know, the imaginary animals. And as Joe Rohde said, that's the whole narrative for Disney's Animal Kingdom, is people's love for animals. He said even dinosaurs, paleontology is the love of extinct animals. And it's an unrequited love because they're dead. They're not coming back. That's it. You know? And that was fascinating. You know, that this was going to be Busch Gardens on steroids here. You know, and it was going to have that conservation message in there, which was very much in keeping with the philosophy of Walt Disney, you know, and the true life adventures and all of that.
Right. But what ends up happening is there are, you know, a lot of times when Disney opens up a new park like this, they open it in phases, right? So phase one mm-hmm. was going to have the lands that were there. It was going to have Discovery Island, which was called, it was going to be called Genesis at one point. It had Discovery mm-hmm. Island, and it had Africa, and they end up spending not only 3 years, but about $800 or so million just to get that phase one open. And they feel, yeah. We do have this idea to build this dragon themed area, but our name kind of has it. Animal is in the name, so I think we need to spend the rest of our resources in building not this mythical land, but we need to continue to build Africa and Asia. And if we are going to start building one more land, we also have this dinosaur movie that was doing really well. Maybe that is where we should start focusing some of our efforts as well.
Well, actually, the dinosaur movie was not doing well. We're getting ahead of the story here, but but yes, you're absolutely right. Disney had never dealt with this many live animals before, so they had no idea. And in addition to that, now you're dealing with the fact that you're Disney, so you've got to take really good care of these animals because you're going to be under scrutiny. We see what happened with SeaWorld out here in Orlando with the blackfish, documentary. It literally almost killed that park mm-hmm. in terms of attendance, in terms of money, in terms of expansion, all that. So Disney has to spend additional money so that it can be accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, AZA, and then you've got to have these backstage areas. And by golly, these animals are eating a ton of food every day. So, you know, you have all of this, so you've got to start making cutbacks. And the cutbacks weren't just Beastly Kingdom. The cutback there was an addition. If you look at the original plan for Animal Kingdom, there was an additional 75 acres for Africa mm-hmm. that they cut. And there was going to be this whole wonderful curving waterway, boat ride through Africa, too. That got cut. And Dinosaur, what people don't realize is that when Dinosaur was being made, that's when Disney was having those problems with Pixar. The contract was running out with Pixar. And so Pixar decided that the very first film they were going to do once the Disney contract was up was a film about a rat, you know, Ratatouille. So that was a way of getting back at Disney. That's where that came from. But with Dinosaur was Disney is setting up its own CGI. You know, we're going to show Pixar, we're going to have some leverage here. We're going to show Pixar, we don't need you. We can do it ourselves, see? And so, but Disney had no idea, you know, what was involved. And so Dinosaur was becoming this money pit. because you're constantly needing new equipment, upgrading, and going back and doing these things. And Dinosaur kept changing. Originally, the concept for the movie was absolutely wonderful. There was going to be no talking at all. It was all going to be, you know, pantomime there. The dinosaurs were going to be much more realistic. Concept artwork by William Stout, who I just love as an artist. And so all of this, and Dinosaur is going way over budget, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, it's just sucking in that money. So we've got to do everything we can, you know, to boost that up. And so even in Dinoland, they're making cuts. So there was going to be that whole roller coaster in the sand pit there. It was going to be called the Excavator, where you're in these ore carts, and it was going to be very much like Big Thunder Mountain. And so that got cut. And Joe Rohde was upset about that because he says, look, you want this to be competitive with Busch Gardens, and they have all these roller coasters. You're cutting the roller coasters. Mm-hmm. And they said, we're going to go with Countdown to Extinction because we can save money because we'll use the exact same ride vehicles that we're using for Indiana Jones out in Disneyland, you know, so we don't have to invent anything new, you know, so we need to promote the film, you know, we need to make it successful because we need to have that leverage to go 90-90-90 to Pixar, but we've got to cut the money. And then, in addition, Disney has that relationship with McDonald's, and McDonald's is going to sponsor all of Dinoland USA, right? So that's going to be a cost savings. And also, McDonald's is partnering with Disney and the Field Museum, Chicago's Field Museum, to buy that dinosaur skeleton, Tyrannosaurus named Sue, which is now in the Field Museum. And then they made two copies, one that McDonald's sent on promotions and one that's over in Dinoland. But it's like, we've got to save money. McDonald's doesn't seem to be interested in buying into Beastly Kingdom, but they're interested in buying into the dinosaurs. So, you know, we can do this. But, you know, what was happening is Disney was literally bleeding money, and so they just kept cutting back and cutting back and cutting back. And as a result, that's why when people first went to Animal Kingdom, they thought of it as just a half-day experience because there was not a lot of things mm-hmm. there. And of course, they just had nickels and dimes left, and so in that hole that was going to be Beastly Kingdom, it's like, what can we do quickly and cheaply? And Eisner had huge success doing Mickey's Birthday Land over at the Magic Kingdom. From conception to it actually opening was 90 days. That was it. So in Eisner's mind is, we can put something in there. And Joe Rohde and the Imagineers were just so teed off about this whole, you're not going to do Beastly Kingdom. You can't tell the boss no, but you can say, look, we're just so swamped with this other work, we can't do Camp Mickey Minnie because we have to be. And so Eisner turned it over to Entertainment. Mm-hmm. Walt Disney World Entertainment is the one that was really responsible for Camp Minnie Mickey. Some Imagineers came in for doing some of the designs, but basically it was all Walt Disney World Entertainment. And the concept was, this is just going to be a temporary location. You know, it'll be a great place for character meet and greets. And what is the cheapest, quickest thing that we can put in? It's not an attraction. It's entertainment.
Right.
So we'll put in we'll put in Festival of the Lion King. We'll bring in the parade floats from Disneyland. We'll put in Pocahontas and her forest friends. We'll bring in a couple of the props like Grandmother Willow from the Disneyland show over there. And it doesn't make any difference. It's only going to be here a year or two. You know? Who cares? And you know, it's just human nature. How many of us have said, well, we'll just do this for now. We'll go back later and fix this. And you never do. And so, again, and I, we talked about this before we started taping. See, we really should start taping the moment we start talking with each other. This would be fascinating for people. Is that Disney is a business.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, well, these are villains here, and how mean it is that, you know, Disney executives and all this, you know, we're cutting back on money, and they cut it back on this wonderful beastly kingdom, which is the topic of this show, and we've not even
we're
started talking about
it. Well, because I think it's important, Jim, that we talk about why we haven't gotten to it, because, you know, there are those conversations that happen and that realization that, hey, you know, look, we're expecting Camp Minnie and Mickey to only be here for a couple of years, but when they're looking at the numbers in the attendance in 2000, they're saying, hey, you know what, we can't justify the expense of building this entire land with all these attractions and all this technology. The park right now just doesn't justify it. And I think even Joe Rohde sort of had his, you know, his light bulb moment and sort of realized, hey, around 2000, 2001, he's sort of doubtful that this is ever going to get built at all.
Yes. In fact, he talked to the Orlando Business Journal and expressed that, because Disney had told him, we talked about phases, phase one. Well, phase two, the Disney executives had said, look, we love Beastly Kingdom. By 2003, it'll be built and open. And so that's what the Imagineers were hanging on to, that belief of, okay, we just have to be patient, you know, for this to happen. But when Animal Kingdom opened, what happened is it started to drain attendance from the other parks. Eisner's concept was, we'll open this brand new park. It'll be so exciting. So many more people will want to come to Walt Disney World. And because we've got an additional park, they're going to want to extend the time they're out here. You know, this is an excuse for printing money. But what happened is, instead of more people coming, the same amount came. They just didn't spend time at the Magic Kingdom or the studios or Epcot. And so attendance at those parks dropped on an average of 10%, which is very, very significant. And what was happening, too, is that oftentimes once you have that drop, then things even out. You know, oh, yes, people have experienced Animal Kingdom now. Now they're going back to the – that wasn't happening. And so the money that they were keeping in reserve for Beastly Kingdom now has to be devoted to shoring up the other parks with a new attraction or a new show or something like that, you know, to keep people, hey, remember, we have these other parks over here and you love these, you know, come on over. Here's something new. And Disney's philosophy is it takes between 3 to 5 years on average for people to save up to come to a Walt Disney World vacation. So you really only need something new every 3 years, you know, more or less to bring people in. But so, you know, this is almost like a perfect storm. It's like, well, we don't have money to build this, but we're going to set aside some money and we'll get back to this. And oh, my gosh, now we've got to use that money for, you know, another emergency, you know. The car broke down. The kids need braces. Right. All of that. You know, we can't do all of these things. But you know, there is a sadness. This was one of Rohde's dream projects. You know, and in fact, I don't know if you know this. I talked with Joe Rohde many years ago and did an interview with him, and I don't know if you know this, but Beastly Kingdom, once Animal Kingdom was greenlit, January 1990, Beastly Kingdom was the very first thing the Imagineers worked on, and why? Any guesses?
So I was going to, because my understanding was that the Beastly Kingdom concept art was some of the first stuff that they had come up with. But in terms of why, other than maybe Joe Rohde just being a Beastly Kingdom champion, I don't know.
Very pragmatic. And again, I didn't know this. I don't see this anywhere else. So those of you who are listening to Lou's show, remember, always listen to Lou's show. You're going to find out information you can't find anywhere else. And I got this from Rhodey himself. He said, we started, and again, it wasn't called Beastly Kingdom in the beginning. It was just this circle on a piece of paper that said myth and fantasy on it. And he said, we started on that section first because we're Imagineers. We're Disney. We know griffins. We know dragons. We need we know unicorns. We know all of that stuff. And so we started on that to buy ourselves time because we didn't know anything about any of the other stuff. He says, by starting on that, that bought us time so we could travel around the country and visit zoos and, you know, make connections with people and figure out zoo conservation and what do we really want to do and what do we really not want to do. And he says, even though Eisner said we're going to do this, the company hadn't bought off on the park yet. So we only had $250,000 startup for the project, you know, budgeted to us. Mm. You know, what are you going to do with $250,000? He said, at Disney, that lasts about long enough to buy yourself breakfast. That's it, you know? So we're going to start with the fantasy part because we have that. We have all of those things in the, you know, in the file and the morgue and all of that of creatures and all of that. And, yeah, you know? We could come up with dark rides. We could do that. And it looks like progress is going on so that we can go out and we can do all those other things. Amazing, isn't it?
You know, it's really interesting to hear how that happens. And then you know, you almost get the sense, too, when you see and read quotes by or about Rhodey in terms of Beastly Kingdom, this is something that he was very much personally invested in because it sounded like a project that, like you said, would allow that Imagineer creativity to really come out. And as we start to sort of dive into, you know, what would have been, I think you'll see why he and probably so many other people were disappointed that it never got built.
Yeah, well, and believe it or not, that original concept, we're talking 1990, 1991, mm-hmm. whatever, is Beastly Kingdom, you know, eventually, as you and I both know, got divided into the good realm and the bad realm. But the original concept there was actually going to be three sections that was tentatively, you know, again, placeholder names, nice, beautiful, and dangerous. And I saw the sketch that Rhodey had done. And basically, the nice section was all the pre-adolescent stuff, things that would appeal to kids, things like unicorns. Mm. You know, so it's non-threatening. It's that magical. The beautiful section would have been the little bit more edgy, where you get things like minotaurs. So there's that sense that, you know, maybe this guy is not, you know, going to be friendly. Maybe there's an element of danger. And then the danger, you were walking through, believe it or not, Jabberwock Woods. Hmm. To get to the dragon. And then, of course, you know, you and I have been around long enough to know that at Imagineering, things are constantly in flux because it's a collaborative art. People are you know, tossing in their ideas. Some things are shifting. Some things are changing. And so it then came down to there were going to be two sections, a good realm and a bad realm. And, you know, I joked about this earlier, but the entrance was going to be over a bridge. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is it was going to be based on the classic Norwegian fairy tale, Three Billy Goats Gruff, about three goats who are trying to cross a bridge, but it's guarded by a troll who is underneath. And so they have to trick the troll in order to get across the bridge. And in fact, at one point there was a discussion of having three audio animatronic goats tied up, you know, on one side of the bridge and, you know, maybe even having the actual troll there or whatever, so that you know, before you even enter the land, you're getting that sense of the storybook and all of that. And again, you mentioned that sometimes Beastly Kingdom is spelled B-E-A-S-T-I-L-E and K-I-N-G-D-O-M-M-E. And the reason, and that was there for a couple of minutes before it got tossed, but it was there to try and create that sense of this is a medieval storybook, you know? And one of the reasons it got tossed is it was too medieval. You know, and some of the creatures you were going to see in there were not medieval. You know, they were from Greek mythology. They were from, you know, other eras and all of that. But it was like, oh yeah, this is well. And again, you sit around, you know, with your friends and have a couple of beers, and you go, yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. People will really get that. But yeah, so it funneled down. You know, as things usually do, is there'll be a good place and there'll be a bad place. So maybe we should start talking about what's going to be in the good place and what's going to be in the bad place.
And it makes perfect sense, because every story is about that simple concept, right? It's about good versus evil. So having those mm-hmm. two paths, and I'll post a lot of this concept art in the show notes, because I think it's important as you listen to be able to visualize what it looked like, because as you entered over that bridge, you were sort of given the choice of taking these two different pathways. Mm-hmm. Down one was going to take you to the good side, but I think we're going to start on the dark side, as it were, because I think that was really one of the iconic elements of the park. But you were going to go through a very winding, dark, you know, forested pathway. Mm-hmm. And as you walked through, you were going to see like suits of armor that had, you know, char marks on them and lances in the ground and all these vents. It was going to be a very sort of earthy thing that was going to lead to you going to the Dragon's Tower, which was that land's. It wasn't just the icon. It was really going to be sort of the weenie of that section of the land, the thing that was going to bring you over and obviously house its e-ticket dark ride, you know, roller coaster type attraction.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This was even though it's called Dragon's Tower, it really was a castle. And again, the whole storyline, of course, was that this massive dragon came and he devastated the original inhabitants. And it's interesting that Disney would have, you know, the melted armor and the broken lances, but no skeletons, you know. So I guess this must have happened a long, long time ago. So all human remains turned to dust. So only
they all got away, but, Jim. They were off. The actual inhabitants of the armor were fine. They ran away. That's all.
Oh, they ran away. Oh, right. See, I'm not thinking Disney enough. But yes, this was going to be a castle, and again, not just a castle, but as you were alluding to, it's massive. It just reaches out, you know, looms out from this gnarled forest, and it shows what had happened during the attack. So yes, it's charred from fire burns, the dragon's fiery breath. You know, there are sections missing from the castle. You know, it looks like maybe this isn't really steady. This could fall at a moment or two, and you know, again, very, very impressive. And as you said, it's that weenie that is drawing you closer and deeper, you know, into the land for this to happen.
And I think too, this was going to be a very unique coaster experience, especially for Walt Disney World. This was going to be a very immersive, very thrilling type ride. So you had things like Space Mountain, but this was going to be something, even just in terms of the ride system itself. You know, you were sort of be joining these bats, and sort of the bats would have been part of what your ride vehicle would have looked like. And you've seen concept art where the coaster was inverted, or it might have been a swinging, suspended type coaster mm-hmm. that took you through these, it was inside, would take you through these caverns and, like you said, these chambers that were collapsing. And then you have this grand finale inside this dragon's den where this dragon is sitting on this treasure that the bats are trying to steal. But you really have a dragon figure, which is sort of a climax to this three act play that you're going through.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the dragon is also jewel encrusted. So it's very much as if it was inspired by, the villainous Smaug from Tolkien's The Hobbit, you know, who has all of these jewels stuck to him, and he's guarding this treasure, you know, untold riches for this to happen. And he's greedy and, you know, not the type of guy you want to hang around with. And yes, next to the castle were caves. And so that's how you enter the ride, is you're going through these caves, and the caves eventually connect into the, what would be the basement or the dungeon of the castle or whatever. And that's where you're going to board the roller coaster, board the attraction. But as you're going through the caves overhead, you've got a colony of bats. And that's what you call a group of bats, a colony. You have a colony of bats overhead, and they're whispering to you. They're convincing you to go on this heist. You know, how easy it is, and the dragon is sleeping. You know, it would be so easy, and we're going to help you to fly, and you'll fly with us, you know. And as you said, once you got on that, it was a real thrill ride, because, again, the castle had been damaged, so apparently as you're going through, parts of the castle are collapsing, you know, or creaking or tipping towards you. You know, and you're going through dark areas where, you know, the torches had been blown out and the whole bit. And then again, as you said, the big climax is you're in this huge area where all the gold and riches are, and you've got the dragon. And the dragon was going to be the largest and most sophisticated audio animatronics figure that Disney had ever built up to that time. And to put that in perspective is 10 years earlier, they did the A-100, which was the Wicked Witch in the Wizard of Oz scene, you know, that still to this day looks so realistic that people think maybe that's an actress who, you know, they've done up in the makeup. And so, you know, Disney had advanced in a decade, for crying out loud. So we can only imagine, you know, how impressive this was going to be. And in fact, the dragon was so impressive. You alluded to this beforehand. He's featured on, still to this day, on the Animal Kingdom logo. He's right dead center, marching along with the other animals. McDonald's produced a Happy Meal figure, which I know I have somewhere. And of course, it's not mint because I pulled it out of the bag to play with it. But a winged purple dragon there. I don't know if he would have been purple in the attraction, but he was purple in the Happy Meal. And you've got a dragon head, I think, on one of the ticket booths, right? Mm-hmm. At the entrance. Right. And so the dragon was going to be the Mickey Mouse of Beastly Kingdom, I guess, for that to happen. And again, the climax, you're confronted with this fiery breath, of course, you know, propane. Flaming propane coming out, and that would have made me wet my pants. So but again, since it's a suspended inverted roller coaster, I'm not wetting any seats or anything at that
point.
But
you referenced the Yeti and Expedition Everest before. You know, if you think about it, it's the same kind of thing. This climactic scene, instead of having the giant Yeti when he used to be able to swing his arm, you would have this dragon that would be breathing fire. You would feel the heat on you. You wouldn't be inside a giant snow-capped mountain. You would be in this crumbling tower. And so Imagine that kind of impact that it would have on you as a guest when that is your the climactic scene that you would have, and it would be a multi-sensory type experience, not just what you see and hear, but what you actually feel with that heat on you.
Well, as the kids say today, awesome. Awesome experience. I don't know if the kids still say that today, but and again, also in you would have been very hungry after that. So in that dark realm, in the bad realm, they had a food and beverage location. It was by the waterfront and was called Loch Ness Terrace. Mm-hmm. And as you were eating periodically outside, you know, in the water, that sea serpent-like creature would, you know, make appearances, and he wasn't like the goofy, friendly, you know, serpent in some of Disney's animated films and all of this. This, again, this is the dark area. This is the bad realm. So this is like, I wonder what the Loch Ness monster eats. Right. Maybe it's me.
And if you look at that original, you know, that sort of that overarching original concept art, you see the Loch Ness monster on that, and he was huge. I mean, he wasn't just going to be a small figure that's going to pop up and down. It was, and if you sort of remember the old topiary that used to be, that sort of made me think of that multi-hump topiary that used to be in Magic Kingdom by Tomorrowland. You would have something even larger and animatronic or pneumatic in the water.
Yes. Yes, and again, it's important when listeners go to your site to take a look at the concept art to remember that this is just concept art. That if it had progressed, it would have developed in lots of different ways. You know, over the years, both Lou and I have seen concept art, seen actual models of things that Imagineering have made that didn't go anywhere beyond that, or would then suddenly evolve into something even more awesome, super awesome.
Well, and the other thing
for that to happen, I'm glad you're going to be posting the concept art so that people
you have to see it, because you can't visualize it in your mind, and then when you see it, you know. And look, one of the things that I loved was not just the concept art of the attraction itself, but as you came out, you were in this little hamlet. You were in this beautiful medieval village, and whether they stayed or not, you not only had this tower sort of looming over you, but you were in this plaza that had these stones in a circle that is obviously very intentionally reminiscent of Stonehenge.
Wait a minute. Is this Harry Potter's Wizarding World we're talking about here?
Listen, that's the other
this
dark
immersive
place.
Environment in this village. And
well, look, and to be honest, look, I think Harry Potter took a nod from Disney, because I think what Disney does, Jim, very well is create immersive spaces and environments. When you are in Adventureland, everything that you see is about that story of Adventureland. You don't get any bleed over.
Everything you hear, everything you smell, everything you taste. Yes.
Not everywhere in Universal.
That's why it's so immersive is you're an actor in this story.
Right. And I think not everything in Universal is like that, other than places like Harry Potter or Wizarding World or Diagon Alley, where you are very much, you cross those thresholds, and now all of a sudden you are immersed in that environment. And I think that's what this is going, you know, look, that's part of the Disney storytelling. That's what they do. You are not sort of just riding an attraction. You are in this forest. You are in this village. It's the same thing in New Fantasyland. You know, go through the forest. You enter the castle keep. You are now in this fantasy world. That's exactly what this area was going to be like as well.
Yeah. You know, poor Universal, you know, they just had to settle for Imagineers who got laid off when Beastly Kingdom got shut down and Animal Kingdom opened, and so those Imagineers had to go over to Universal, and I guess Islands of Adventure, they had to come up with things like this ride where you're roller coaster where you're going through this castle where there's a dragon and there's wait a minute.
Yeah, we'll talk we'll talk about that, because in how much maybe that did or did not play in the decision not to keep that forward. But there's another side to the coin, right? We're on this dark side,
Right. Let's go to the good side.
Right,
I prefer the good side. Go to the light. Go to the light.
Good always wins, except in Spaceballs. So the other side, I worry you to take the other pathway. This is much more of a less sinister. This is about unicorns and a boat ride entitled Fantasia Gardens, based on some of the scenes from Fantasia. So there's a Disney connection for those that remember the film, which would take you through some of the scenes in that movie. So if you think, you know, almost analogous to maybe like something like Winnie the Pooh, you would have seen, you know, Dance of the Hours. You would have seen the hippos and the crocodiles and some of the mythical creatures like the centaurs and the fauns and Pegasus and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it may even be closer to It's a Small World, because, again, very family friendly, or even Jungle Cruise. Mm-hmm. And again, you're going, believe it or not, they had pitched Fantasia Gardens for Disneyland years earlier, you know, before this. And so this would have been just gorgeous because you're not just on the water there, but the scenery is you've got this classic Greek architecture. So you've got temples, you've got Mount Olympus, mm-hmm. which was also, you know, in the film there. There was a brightly colored rainbow archway that you went under. There were beautiful gardens. There were bubbling fountains and all of this. And Lou is always good cop. I'm always bad cop. But I'm going to say on the press release, one of the things that I grumble about even to this day, and this is the exact press release, by the way, for that ride. They said, "A gentle musical boat ride through the animals from Disney's animated classic Fantasia. Both the crocodiles and hippos from Dance of the Hours and the Pegasus, fauns, and centaurs from Beethoven's Pastoral are found here." And you're going to say, that grumpy old man, Jim Corcus, what is he? They're saying crocodiles and hippos from Dance of the Hours. And remember, this is an official Disney press release. There are no crocodiles in Fantasia. It's alligators. In fact, the lead character is called Ali E. Gator. You know? Disney, you need to hire a Disney historian or two to go through and double-check these things. But again, that was the point, is this was going to be a family-friendly ride, you know, especially for kids. So there's no sense of threat. You know, it's just this beautiful, you're hearing this beautiful music, you're seeing the alligators and the hippos dancing, you know, the hippos and the tutus and all that, and then you're seeing the flying Pegasus, the fauns, the centaurs, and I really would have loved to have taken that boat ride and seen the female centaurettes, you know, because I would hope they would base them on the Fred Moore design from the film, because they were just cute as all get out there. And so this, my gosh, you know, this was just beautiful.
And it would have been and the other thing too, it would have been the classic Disney family-friendly dark ride. So if maybe, mm-hmm. you know, maybe going to, maybe your kids would not have necessarily liked going or been able to ride the Dragon Challenge, this is something that everybody could have done together as a family.
Well, you see, that was one of the reasons I cheered when Pandora was announced, and they said they were going to have that boat ride through the luminescent forest. And I thought, that is so incredible, because that's finally, instead of all these thrill rides, this is something an entire family can enjoy together. You know, I have a couple of friends who work at Universal Creative, which is the Imagineering counterpart at Universal. And I said, you guys made a huge mistake on the Harry Potter ride. And they said, what do you mean? You know, people are coming in, they love it and all that. I said, there's medical restrictions, there's height restrictions, there's size restrictions. I said, if it was open to everybody, that line would have been out the block and down to Disney property at that particular point, because everybody could have gone on it and enjoyed it. So that's why I was so excited that Pandora is going to have an attraction that everybody can enjoy. Everybody can. And now watch it open and people on the internet go, that's so boring. That's so lame. You know, I wanted that creature to jump out and rip off the head of the guy sitting in front of me there.
Everybody on Twitter is so happy and positive and a lot of kumbaya out there on the internet.
But anyway, Fantasia Gardens would have been beautiful. You know, Fantasia Gardens was also proposed for the Magic Kingdom. They were going to do it in the area where the Swan Boat rides were. And the guy who turned that down is a guy who I just absolutely love and adore and respect, Sully Sullivan.
No kidding.
He was in charge of the Magic Kingdom at that time. And Eisner just loved the pitch for this and all of this. And so, yes, you'd be going through those entire waterways just like the Swan Boats did. But you'd have these little theme things, topiaries and fountains and figures and all of this from Fantasia. And Sully tells this story a lot better than I could ever. But after Eisner goes, yeah, this is beautiful. And Sully follows Eisner into the restroom. And they're standing there at the urinal. And Eisner is going, yeah, that's going to be just so beautiful. And Sully says, I don't want it here in the park. And Eisner says, well, what are you talking about? He says, because it's low capacity, and when it rains, I have to shut the whole thing down. And Eisner leaves the restroom and talks to the rest of the group, and he goes, no, I don't think we're going to go with this.
No kidding.
But there would have been a Fantasia. As I said, originally it was proposed by Mark Davis, of all people, out there in Disneyland, and that was going to be in the motorboat cruise section. Hmm. Isn't that interesting?
You know what? Dots
connect back and forth.
I interviewed Sully Sullivan back on show 39, 10 years ago. I think I still got his number. I'm tempted to just get him on the phone right now and be like, what were you thinking, man?
What he was thinking was, hey, I'm in charge of this park, and I've got to show to people that, you know, we're making money.
Right.
This isn't going to help us make money.
So, but, you know, as beautiful as I think that attraction was going to be, I think the thing that really was going to be the good side's e-ticket was not something that was super high tech. It was not going to be a thrill ride. It was going to be something that was beautiful in its simplicity, in that it was a gigantic hedge maze called Quest for the Unicorn, which was going to be not just something that you wandered through, but was going to be very interactive. And I think this would have been one of the first things. Look, because that's what we're seeing now, Jim. We're seeing a much more of a trend towards
interactivity. The interactive cues and all of that.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is what was going to allow guests to be, as they walked through, you had to try and find and awaken all of these different golden idols that were scattered right throughout the maze. So there was a puzzle that you had to sort of finish and follow.
Decipher, put together, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Again, being able to do together as a family, you know, so there's a familiar, like, you know, there's a bonding element to do with your family or your friends, but there's also a payoff at the end too, because that final piece of the puzzle was going to have that reveal of this amazing unicorn in this cavern with these crystal pools, which is also going to make for a great photo opportunity as well.
Yes. And again, the clues were going to be simple, because you can't have people staying there all day. You know, I haven't gone to the Dragon's Tower. I've been here 8 hours trying to awaken this golden idol here. So again, this is just early concept, how it would have, you know, played out, you don't know, but try and think of it like the Kim Possible adventure, or the Agent P thing, or even Sorcerers of the Magic Kingdom, you know, a very early version of that type of thing. And yeah, you would not only were there the five golden idols, but inside the maze there were also additional magical, mythological creatures, you know, that you would pass by. And yes, you would try and figure these things out, and then you would go, and once you got all the pieces put together or all the clues put together, so that maybe there's that magic word or the magic code or whatever, it opens up, and yes, you've got this beautiful, beautiful white unicorn with a solid gold horn, you know, and it's pawing at the ground and it's nodding its head so the horn is pointing to you. My gosh, you know, I could just see people, you know, going crazy there. I don't know. I never would have thought of that as an attraction, but by golly, Imagineers did.
And I think it's something that would have worked. And look, this, you know, to be clear, you know, we were talking about some of this stuff in terms of where it was in terms of concept and on drawing board. This was one of the things, Jim, that was very much already starting to become into production. And I can't seem to find it while we've been recording. But ages ago, somebody sent me a picture of one of the statues of the Griffin that was actually built and was delivered to Disney specifically for this, for the Quest for the Unicorn attraction.
Mm-hmm.
So the plane was already in flight. I mean, there were plans definitely to make this happen. But, you know, certainly we'll get into some of the reasons why it didn't. But
And again, you've got to start production early in order to, you know, be prepared. So, for instance, Thunder Mesa, which I'm sure you've talked about on the podcast before, they created a audio animatronic buffalo and gophers or whatever that were done. And so when that got canceled, they moved that over, and that's over in a scene in the land, mm-hmm. In Epcot, over in Future World. Those were created for that attraction, but it's like, no, nope, we're canceling that attraction, so let's find another prairie dogs and a buffalo, mm-hmm. not a gopher. Just have too much stuff inside my mind. And you know, when we talk about, and none of it is any good. None of it is any good. All of it is useless. You know, I could go into a McDonald's and spout some of this stuff off. Nobody's going to give me a free Happy Meal here. You know, we talked about the land itself. There was actually a preview to the land, the Discovery River boats.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever go on those, Mr. Lou?
I have a vague recollection of going on what was, and I'm sure I know for a fact, it was not the most eventful boat ride at Disney's Animal Kingdom.
I think that's an understatement because, again, Disney did surveys. It was, when it opened, it was the most hated attraction yeah. on Walt Disney World property because there was nothing there.
Right.
You would wait for 30 minutes or whatever to get on this boat, and it was like a 4 or 5 minute ride to Harambe, but there was nothing there, but that's not the way it was supposed to be. There were dragon rocks. There were, went by a cave and you heard a growl. Mm-hmm. And then as the boat passed, suddenly this dragon's head, came out of the cave and it would have been, again, saving money. It would have been the exact same dragon that's, underneath, the castle, the sleeping dragon in Disneyland Paris, but actually not the whole dragon. It's only the top third of the dragon because you only need to see the head and part of the neck. And it pops out and it blows out this propane ball of fire at you. And then your captain on the boat is really worried. And it's like, but we escaped the dragon. What are you worried about? And it's because he's afraid that all of this noise and activity has awoken the Kraken. Unleash the Kraken. And you're going, wait a minute, the Kraken? And then around the boat, there'd be all this bubbling going on as if there's something stirring underneath. And then in the distance, you see this fin coming towards you. And it's not like a simple, nice Jaws fin. This is a And so the captain on the ship has to pull out a lyre to pluck a tune to put the Kraken back to sleep. You know, it's not like the Jungle Cruise where you pull out the gun and fire at the hippo. You know, now we're in 1998. We're politically correct. You can't fire the gun at the Kraken. You play the lyre to put him to sleep. And then you also go around a bend, and we were talking about that beautiful unicorn. You see briefly in this grove of trees, again, the beautiful white unicorn. It's moving slightly, you know, because horses don't move a lot. And especially if you've seen the horse in American Adventure at Epcot, they don't move a lot, but they move enough. So you go, I wonder if that's real. And so you'd see that, and then you would go, and so, oh, my gosh, this is so wonderful. And then, of course, when the budget got cut, there's nothing there. And Rhodey went, and he just begged Eisner, we've got to have something out there. And so the best they could come up with was you hear a growl in the cave, and then a blast of fire, you know, comes out of it. That's it.
Yeah, you know, weren't there suits of armor there for a little while on the riverbank?
For a while, and then they got guest complaints that it was morbid.
Right. Well, it's just like.
But again, it was those same suits of armor that would have been that had been made, I guess, for that forest that would have led into the Dragon's Tower.
Right. Well, it's just like when people used to complain about
that. Of course, everybody inside had already run away, so that's why the suits were.
Right.
But again, you could see that there were sections that were melted, the things broken, all of that. And so that was to indicate, yes, there's a dragon in here and he's very dangerous. But again, they removed that because, yes, we're complaining. That's very morbid. That scares my child.
Well, say it's,
but
it's
now
like,
there's nothing to see.
Frontierland with the burning cabin, there used to be, you know, dead settlers out there way back when. And
yes,
you know.
Yes. Who had been. And obviously what we learned from the Mark Twain experience was the bad Indians were on the right-hand side because they were burning the settler's cabin and putting an arrow through him and attacking, you know, the fort there. But the good Indians were on the left-hand side because the one on the horse was waving at us, and there's this nice little village where they're not doing anything except, you know, cooking and, you know, carving the canoe and all of that. But, you know, things, times change, things change, and perceptions change, and jokes that I made 5 years ago, I would never even consider making today, for crying out loud. And listeners are going, oh, Jim makes jokes? When is he going to do that on the podcast? but, you know, so there were all those other elements there that were tying into that. And then, of course, it's a domino effect. Once you cut one thing, then all these other things start getting cut and they just don't make sense anymore. You know? Very, so, very sad.
So,
and you know, they tried to rescue the Beastly Kingdom concept, interestingly enough, because, you know, people were leaving Disney Animal Kingdom early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing to see. And there's no fireworks show because, you know, it's going to scare the animals and they need to go to sleep and all of that. And so the execs got around and said, what can we do to, you know, extend the evening hours, keep people there, you know? And one of the concepts they had was the Rivers of Light Parade.
Mm-hmm.
That just like the Electrical Light Parade was going to go through the park, but again, the pathways are too narrow. You'd have to cut back a lot of the landscaping for that, and also to make room for people to stand. And if anybody ever saw the March of the Artimals, it was hard enough for that parade to get through in daylight, let alone
right.
at night. But the other thing they considered doing was, we're going to put Beastly Kingdom back on the thing. But we're not going to do this Quest of the Unicorn, namsy-pamsy stuff. We're going to put in Disney characters. So there would be dragons, but the dragons would be Elliot and Maleficent's dragon. You know, that type of thing. We're going to pull mythological creatures and all of this from, you know, licensed Disney properties here. So we can include that in there. So for about 5 minutes, you know, that was considered that, and Beastly Kingdom was back on the books there for about 5 minutes for that to happen. But what really stuck a nail in the coffin for Beastly Kingdom is when Universal's Islands of Adventure opened, and Joe Rohde and the Imagineers hoped that that would be an overwhelming success. And why would you want a competitor to be a success? Because if it was such a huge success, Disney has to do something to counter that, you know? So they'd put Beastly Kingdom back, because all this work's already been done. Just tell us, go. We're ready to go, you know? But Islands of Adventure underperformed. And one of the reasons is Universal. Universal really didn't market it as a second theme park. Mm-hmm. They do now, but in those days they didn't market it as a second theme park, and so people just thought it was an extension of Universal Studios. You know? So why should I come down there and see that? But, you know, it really worried people. It worried Michael Eisner. And so you know what Michael Eisner did, right?
Well, I mean, I try to go back a second, because I think part of the problem too, Jim, is when former Disney Imagineers go to the place that the sun does not shine and they create a land based on dueling dragons and based on some of these concepts that Disney had, had sketched out years earlier, by Disney following up with the opening of a Beastly Kingdom, while we might know that it was in the works for years, it I think to the average person might look at, well, look at Disney now trying to copy what Universal had done successfully or unsuccessfully first.
Yes. No, you are absolutely right. When Universal Island of Adventures opened, Eisner went there incognito. I don't know if he actually wore a physical disguise or not, but he went with a couple of Disney staff, and he went in there because he was very worried, you know, is this going to be successful? Is this appealing to an older audience than what we're appealing to? Mm. And he goes in there, and yeah, there's a coaster called Dueling Dragons, which has now been transformed to what? Dragon Challenge for Harry Potter there. These dragons in this decrepit castle. And he looked over and he goes, does that look familiar to you guys?
and wait a minute.
For unicorns, there was a flying unicorn coaster. And for a restaurant, for a themed, there was, what was it? Enchanted Oak Tavern, you know? And so if anything put a nail in the coffin, that was it, because it's exactly as you say. Even though Disney had developed all of this first, and Disney probably would have done it even better, to the general public, that makes no difference.
Right. And then look, you can't say, well, let's just get rid of Dragon's Tower and let's get rid of this. Now, all of a sudden, the e-ticket attraction, the weenie, the thing that was going to really draw people to this part of the land at Animal Kingdom is now gone. You know, you lose sort of the critical element in order to be able to justify building Beastly Kingdom.
Well, and as we were talking about too, no idea at Imagineering ever goes to waste. They put it on the shelf, and sometimes they bring it out or they readapt it or whatever. I see elements from the Beastly Kingdom in those proposals for the Dark Kingdom, mm-hmm. where the weenie was going to be Maleficent's castle, or Fire Mountain.
Fire Mountain, right.
Where you were going to be on that suspended roller coaster and your feet would be over lava and all of that as you're dashing around. And Dark Kingdom, what was it? They were going to have Bald Mountain there where the villains were chasing you through and on the outside of the mountain as well there. So I'm wondering if some of those Beastly Kingdom proposals, you know, they kept, you know, trying to pump new life into them and say, well, you know, you're thinking of this new area. Here's a really super new thing, you know?
Right. You redress the concept to fit in. Mm-hmm. And look, not that I ever think a villain's fifth gate is ever going to really come to pass, but you're right. You don't know. Look, it's a beautiful
Listen,
concept.
You never know. I would, if somebody had said, well, you know, they're going to have a section at Animal Kingdom, you know, devoted to Jim Cameron's movie. I go, yeah, right.
But you know, there's a huge difference between building a land where the infrastructure is sort of already there versus breaking ground to create an entirely new fifth gate. I mean, it's a monumental undertaking and certainly one that, you know, it does not happen easily or lightly. I think there's a lot more expansion that's going to happen in the existing parks before, if and when a fifth gate ever comes to be. But I think you're right. I think this concept and some of these concepts, because they were so good, because they were so attractive, are ones that we may see resurrected elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously going through modification and adaptation. And as we keep saying, these are just concepts, you know, things develop from there. At Disneyland, the first concept for Mr. Toad's Wild Ride was going to be a roller coaster, you know, so very much like Gadget's Go Coaster or Goofy's Barnstormer or whatever, you know, it would be a slight roller coaster, but it would still have been a roller coaster. And the plans for the Storybook Land ride out there in Disneyland, you were going to be swallowed by Monster of the Whale and then go down this water flume inside and burst out, you know, through his tail to get into that. So, and, you know, as exciting as all of these are, you know, after a while, you start to go, okay, we've got to take into account, you know, load capacity. We've got to take into account, you know, maintenance on these things and all of this. And sometimes there's even just a better idea. A dragon? Why don't we have a two-headed dragon? And one of them spurts out fire and the other spurts out cold, you know? And we'll call them Anna and Elsa. You know, this will work. Oh, wait a minute. No, we'll bring out Anna and Elsa later on something else. but again, I would have liked to have seen a Beastly Kingdom in 1998. And no, I don't think there is a hope for the Beastly Kingdom to, as it is, be revived. You know, but again, you never know. You never say never. Anything could happen. But I think if Beastly Kingdom had opened, I think people would have had a different first impression of Animal Kingdom.
Right.
You know, so I think if they had had the roller coaster, the excavator in Dinoland USA, which was meant to be there, they would have had a different impression as well,
right? On opening day, right? If it could have been there on opening day.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you mentioned Expedition Everest and the Yeti, and when I talked with Joe Rohde and I said, well, you must be happy now because now you really do have, you know, an element of the Beastly Kingdom. You know, you have the Yeti. And he looked at me like I had two heads, and he said, no. He said the Yeti is that is on that border between real and mythological. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, we're just not sure. he says, so it's not completely imaginary. It's not completely fanciful, because so many people have these sightings of this, and these sightings have taken place, you know, over hundreds of years. So there really may be that type of creature. The fact that we've made him this protector spirit, that has that element of mythology in it.
So
but he says, nope.
I'll ask
he's still grumpy about it. Beastly Kingdom.
Yeah, note to self: don't bring up Beastly Kingdom to Joe Rohde if you ever meet him if you ever see him at Tiffin somewhere. So maybe a somewhat unfair question for a variety of reasons. One of which is that we are so close to one of them actually opening. Do you think you, Jim Corcus, and you, the listener, do you think you would have preferred Beastly Kingdom over Pandora? Understanding that now you've actually seen beyond concept art of Pandora, you've seen video, you sort of know more about what is coming there?
Well, my personal opinion is I love dragons. I love unicorns. I love all of that stuff. I would have loved to have seen things devoted to that, especially with a Disney twist. From what I have seen of Pandora, because initially my reaction was very, very negative, but from what I've seen now, I am very intrigued to go, because I never felt the movie was a movie. The movie, to me, was an event, and I didn't come out of that movie remembering the names of any of the characters or wanting to go get a plush banshee or anything like that. It seems to me that Imagineering has created a land that is not necessarily dependent upon the movie.
Right.
I don't think you have to have seen the movie or any of the sequels, which again are delayed, I guess. You don't have to have seen the movie or any of the sequels to go in and enjoy the beauty and the strangeness of this land, and everything that I've seen, and all of the and you've probably seen more than I have, or even seen more supporting material. Everything there shows me that this could be a success, not because of the movies, but in spite of the movies,
right.
Because it's creating, as you keep saying, that immersive experience, and as I said, I'm really looking forward to the boat ride, especially. Not as excited about riding a banshee, because you know, as I get older, this shaking up and down and all of that, you know, I don't care for it.
Look, I've said, you know, ad nauseum, and forgive me if I'm repeating myself on the show, that I wish I had the time and the talent to be able to go in and take Avatar the film and edit it down, not from the fighting scenes and some of the story, but if I could edit it down to showcase the beauty of that world, that the bioluminescent mm-hmm. lights, how the messaging fits in with Animal Kingdom, I think that might change people's opinion. Look, I believe, Jim, that when
I think you're probably right, because I think a lot of people took a look at the film and said, "Well, this is just the Pocahontas story,"
right? Or they didn't like the violence in it, right?
You know, and I think Joe Rohde takes in the pre-publicity here takes that larger view that no, this is actually a story about, you know, being in tune with nature, being in tune with the animals. You know, all of this, and so that's very much, you know, with the philosophy of Animal
right,
Kingdom.
Right. Look, the conservation and, you know, living with the land, to use an Epcotism, is the mm-hmm. messaging of Disney's Animal Kingdom at the very beginning. And look, I think this is going to, and look, remember when Cars Land was first announced? The mm-hmm. same kind of thing happened. People lost their collective marbles because maybe they didn't like the film, but then when you take yourself out of it and you step into that land in Disneyland, and all of a sudden you're in Radiator Springs, you're like, holy smokes, like I am in this film. And
it just all works. Yes, right. I've been in Cars Land, and yeah, it I and Cars is not my favorite Pixar film. But
you don't have to like Pandora. No, you don't have to love the film, like the movie,
to really appreciate that whole experience.
And I think that's what's going to happen very much so when Pandora opens. I for one, was excited when I heard about it. Initially, I'm even more so now as we are recording and leading up to just a few weeks away until it opens. I think it is going to put Animal Kingdom.
So, are you on that list to get that special media preview?
I am going during the special event. I'm grateful to have been invited to it, but I'm excited, Jim, because look, whether it's Pandora or Cars Land or I feel as though the company, and more importantly, Imagineering, has earned our trust. Like, they know what they're doing. I believe in the vision. And when I say the vision, I don't just mean the technology, but the storytelling. And I'm imagining what this land is going to look like and sound like and feel like, especially at night. And when you walk through that portal and you're transported off world, I'm excited for that type of experience. And I think what we see here is going to be just the tip of the iceberg in terms of immersive storytelling and technology that we're going to get when Star Wars Land, whatever they're going to call it, is going to open a number of years from now.
Well, and you know, with the I'm surprised that Avatar Land is opening, you know, as early as May. I think that's a great idea, you know, to catch the summer crowds and all that. I didn't think it was going to be ready in time for that. But it really is just the opening shot for, you know, in another year or so we get Toy Story Land, and then another year or so we get Star Wars Land. You know, this is pretty impressive.
And I think,
you know,
what's going to happen.
And I would agree with you that when Disney does something right, they really do it right.
And I will put my money where my mouth is, little Jimmy Corcus. So one day, you and I are going to go to Pandora together. And you said that when you left the film Avatar and you wiped all the popcorn off your fingers, you didn't feel compelled to go out and get a little Navi action figure or a Banshee for your shelf.
I couldn't even remember the names of the characters. So,
I can't either. But if you go to Pandora and you're like, OMG, I need to get a little Banshee, I will take you to the souvenir store and I will buy one for you.
I wonder how many people, especially little kids, will look at that female Navi shaman and go, oh, she's Pandora. I want to go see Pandora, Miss Pandora again. I thought Pandora
was a jewelry company. Wait a minute.
Oh, my gosh. Talk about synergy.
Right?
They should be selling Pandora jewelry.
If Pandora, the jewelry company, does not get in on this, they are missing a huge opportunity. But look, time is going to tell, Jim Corcus. We are literally, as the time of recording this, we are weeks away from Pandora opening. I will tell you that there is a little slash big part of, you know, little Lou Mangiello that wishes Beastly Kingdom would have been built. I would have loved to have seen this Dragon Tower and that type of experience. Believe it or not, man, that maze sounded so intriguing to me. I loved the simplicity. I loved the interactivity of it. I thought about walking through this hedge maze and knowing that there was a payoff for my efforts at the very end. So there's a little part of me that's sad that we'll never see it in that incarnation, but who knows what the future might bring. What I do know that the future is going to bring, nice segue, Lou Mangiello, is more segments with Jim Corcus. More importantly,
I can only hope, because I have so much fun with this, and I hope the listeners enjoy hearing all of this stuff, and I hope they take this and then share it with their friends and family.
And listen, if you can't get enough Jimmy Corcus, and really, who can? I want to give you something, and it's not Jimmy Corcus's home address, but if you call me, I might. What I want to do is I'm going to link in the show notes to all of little Jimmy Corcus's books. Jim, what are you up to? 14 now? 14, 15
Actually,
books?
Actually, there's almost 20.
Holy moly.
And in fact, the latest book, by the time people are listening to this podcast, if they go middle of April, before the tax deadline of April 15th. If they go to Amazon.com, they'll find my latest book, which is Secret Stories of Disneyland. So there are 5 to 10 stories for each of the 8 lands at Disneyland, as well as some stories for Beyond the Berm. And so I've written 2 books about the secret stories of Walt Disney World. They have done very well. And so my publisher asked if I could write about Disneyland, which is more difficult than most people imagine, because there's already so many books out there about Disneyland, hidden secrets and trivia and all this, and websites and DVDs. So I had to really struggle to find some secrets and stories to share. But fortunately, I've interviewed many Imagineers over the years and all that, so I was able to grab some stories. Here, I'll share one of the stories that's in the book. When Disneyland opened, one of the biggest complaints they had was that the clock on the train station was incorrect. And remember, this is 1955, so people are using their watches and trying to set it by, you know, a large, prominent clock so that it could stay on time and do this. So every day they would send out this poor little maintenance guy, and he would put up the ladder and he would go up there and try and, you know, change the clock, and they would get complaints that the clock is wrong. And so Disney had people come down, they talked to this guy, and he said, "What I do?" He said, "I come down," he says, "I phone the main office there in town hall, and I set my watch to that, then I climb up the ladder and I set the clock," and he says, and they're tracking him. This went on for a couple of days. They tracked him. Finally, they put somebody in the office in a town hall, and so when he called, the secretary picked up the phone, and she looked out the window at the clock on the train station and told him the time. So that's one of the stories you probably won't hear anywhere else. And believe it or not, the clock was the last thing that was completed. The clock face was the last thing that was completed on Main Street, because they had put a camera in there to shoot Main Street with that, you know, that sped up stop motion type thing to show the construction of Main Street. So I'm sure you've all seen the images of that. And so the book includes that. It includes the moving snore sound in Disneyland that moves all over the place. It includes a chapter of 2 former Nazis who made significant contributions to Disneyland, ones that you look at and go, "Oh, those are so beautiful. Oh, I love that." And the story behind Adriana Casalotti doing the voice in the Snow White's Wishing Well. So for those of you who are new to Disneyland, I think this will be entertaining. For those of you who are like Lou and I, jaded and all of that, I think this will give you some new insights or a different perspective on some familiar facts. So Secret Stories of Disneyland, Amazon.com, and my newest book that's out there is Gremlin Trouble, which is the story of the Roland Dahl film that was never made. During World War II, Walt was going to do an animated feature about gremlins, the little creatures that, you know, bedeviled pilots and airplanes and all of that, and it was going to be based on a story written by Flight Lieutenant Roland Dahl. His very first book. He later went on to do Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Fantastic Mr. Fox and all that. And so this is the whole story behind, just as we talked about Beastly Kingdom today, this sounds like such a great idea. How come it never got made?
You'll have to read the book to find out.
So thank you, Lou, for having me, and thank you for letting me plug my books.
Absolutely, brother. I will put a link up where people can find all of your books on Amazon.com, and certainly would love to have you back again. There are many more stories to share in the future, and I so very much appreciate you, my friend.
and I appreciate you too. You're a good friend. You have helped so many people, and you have definitely helped me. And more than anything else, I think that is going to be the Lou Mangiello legacy. So we need to get together to eat. We both love to eat. We need to get together to eat. So let's make plans to do that.
Will do, buddy. Time for our Walt Disney World trivia question of the week, where I invite you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World's history, or I want to see how well you pay attention to the details, sometimes in what you see, sometimes in what you hear, maybe even in what you smell, possibly in what you taste. If you think you know the answer, you can enter via our online form for a chance to win a Disney prize package. But before we get to this week's question, we're going to go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So last week, I wanted to see how well you pay attention to something that you probably have heard more than once in an attraction in Walt Disney World. And I asked you to tell me, where in Walt Disney World have you heard...
Is it ever going to warm up? Let's find out with a look at the weather. Will it?
You know those giant glaciers we've all gotten so used to? Well, they're going to be receding to the north and south poles. Conditions are looking very favorable for a whole new kind of mammal. KNRG News Time, 750,000 BC.
And that's our KNRG up-to-the-minute news report. Now back to our regularly scheduled program.
I'm sure hearing the actual audio clip rather than my really bad impression made you remember that it was, of course, from the Universe of Energy / Ellen's Energy Adventure / Ellen's Energy Crisis / coming soon to an Epcot Center near you. Anyway, I took all of the correct entries, randomly selected one, and because I was just in the holiday spirit or really hungry, your prize package includes my 102 ways to save money for an At Walt Disney World book, all seven of my audio tours of the Magic Kingdom, a WW Radio 2.0 Magic Band cover, some stickers, a travel mug, and a mystery prize. And that mystery prize is going to be something from my personal vintage collection. I'll pull it from one of my eBay lots and give it to you instead. It's still a mystery to me as to which one I'm going to give you, or more than one I'm going to give you, but I am going to give you something from my vintage Disney collection. Add that to your prize package. And last week's winner, by the way, randomly selected, is Sharon Peck. So Sharon, congratulations. I do have your mailing address because you did use the online form. I'm going to get your prize package out to you right away. If you played last week and didn't win, that's okay, because here's your next chance to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So this week's question is going to be about food. Shocker, because I'm Lou Mangiello and I'm always hungry. But this one also involves a little bit of Disney history as well, because I want you to tell me the names, plural, of the restaurants on Disney's boardwalk located next to Flying Fish. So it's currently occupied. Hey, look, I'll even give you one of them. It's currently occupied by the Trattoria Al Forno. What I want to know are all the names of the restaurants that have occupied that space since Disney's boardwalk opened. So I've given you one, Trattoria Al Forno. Give me the names of the other restaurants that have occupied that space beforehand. And you have until Sunday, April 23rd at 11:59 p.m. And again, you're playing for the 102 Ways book, the audio tours, which are available in the shop, by the way, at www.radio.com, a Magic Band cover, stickers, and just because I like them and I think you will too, I'm going to throw in another one of the WW Radio hot and cold travel mugs. So good luck and have fun and stay hungry. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you again so very much for taking the time to tune in this and every week. I understand and appreciate how valuable your time is, and I am sincerely grateful that you choose to spend and share some of it with me. Just a couple of quick reminders. Don't forget that I have a new free book for you. It's 102 things to do in Walt Disney World at least once. You can get it again for free just by visiting the homepage of www.radio.com. I also have a new video for you, a new snack of the week at Walt Disney World. I told you I was hungry. You can find that on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WDW Radio or our YouTube channel at youtube.com/WDW Radio. If you have a suggestion for a snack of the week, you can use a contact form right on the site or email me, lou@wdwradio.com. Speaking of liking the Facebook page, I appreciate it if you could go over. Make sure you like the page, because this way you can also not only join us every Wednesday night for our live video broadcasts and chat, either from the home studio or from the parks. It's a great way to talk about Disney. You can also call into the show. Oftentimes, I'm live from the parks, but I'm also working on some new things specifically for the Facebook page. I'd love for you to be part of the conversations there. I want you not just to consume the content, but really share it and be part of it as well. Also, on the Facebook page, we have the WDW Radio 10th Anniversary Logo Contest. As we celebrate 10 years of the WDW Radio show, I want you to cast your vote for the new WDW Radio 10th Anniversary Logo Contest. And then once we have a winner, you'll see exactly what I plan on doing with it there. You have until the end of this week to cast your vote, again, on our Facebook page. And if you want to connect and talk, and if you want to connect with and talk with me other places online, I am at Lou Mangiello on Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and Instagram. But you know, of course, that I always say, because I believe it and it's true, that nothing beats a handshake and a hug. That's why, in addition to connecting with you online, I want to be able to meet and chat with you in person. That's why I do monthly meetups every month in Walt Disney World as other events on our road. Our next meetup in Walt Disney World is going to be this coming weekend during the Star Wars Dark Side Half Marathon Challenge. That's going to be Saturday over at the American Adventure. You can visit our Facebook page for details and to RSVP. It's fun, it's free, it's completely family friendly, and it's open to anyone and everyone, whether you want to just come by and say hi or spend some time with us, grab something to eat as well. I am working on the May Meets of the Month plural, because I am going to be in Disneyland the first weekend, the first week of May, speaking at an event out there, and I plan on probably doing a meet of the month on Wednesday night. Maybe we'll combine it with the live show Wednesday, May 10th. I'll have details and locations and time coming soon. And the Walt Disney World meet of the month, I'm actually still working on dates as well. Also, there's other events coming up, including our cruise to Alaska next year. Again, you can find every information about all this on the events page over on Facebook. Also, I do other events and meetups, not just in Walt Disney World, but on the road as I travel to speak at conferences and events. Go to visit loumangiello.com. You can find out maybe how I can come help speak to your conference, your business, or your school, or work with you one-on-one to turn your passion into your profession. Oh, speaking of which, my Momentum event in Walt Disney World, October 14th now through the 17th, is now 50% sold out, and there are only 3 tickets left for the second add-on Mastermind Day. Whether you are a solopreneur, have an idea, or just want to turn what you love into what you do, this small workshop event, which is limited to just 50 people, is going to help you make real changes in your life and your business with a very intimate, interactive workshop focused on creating real results for you. I'm going to have more details coming soon and more speaker announcements. You know, Duncan Wardle, the former vice president of innovation and creativity for the entire Walt Disney Company, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, is our first announced speaker. For more information, you can visit loumangiello.com. Speaking of thanks, I also want to thank some of the recent members of the WW Radio Nation, including Paul Clark, Ben Barlow, Nancy Turinja, Dave McIntosh, Zach Hoover, Mike Milne, and Eric Siegel. I appreciate you and all of you who are part of the nation. If you want to find out not only how to help support the show, but get exclusive monthly rewards every month, including scavenger hunt, you have access to our private Facebook group. We do live video group calls once a month. There's also logo gear, backpacks, care packages from Walt Disney World, special events, and more. You can visit wdwradio.com/support. Speaking of support, I want to thank the continuing support of Becky over at mousefantravel.com. They have been my official and recommended travel provider for all your vacation needs pretty much since I began WW Radio. You can get a free no-obligation quote by visiting mousefantravel.com. And thanks, as always, to little Timmy Foster from celebrationspress.com, where they can go and find the print and digital versions of Celebrations magazine. And finally, most importantly, I want to thank you and ask that if you like the show, please do me one small favor. take just a couple of seconds and help spread the word. Let others know about it. Tweet out that you're listening to this or your favorite episode. Share it on your Facebook profile, group, or page. And please take 30 seconds just to rate and review the show over on iTunes. Because of you, the show reached number 2 overall among all podcasts. We have more than 1,200 five-star reviews, including one from Josh from Cape May, New Jersey, who says the show is awesome. Evan says, the best Disney podcast out there. Been a fan for years, going to continue to be a fan. Krim Than says, it's the most amazing podcast. I'm blown away how fantastic the podcast is. Beyond wonderful. Words cannot express the joy that Lou brings to a person's life. Wow, thank you so much. I love Canada and your poutine. Rockdog520 says it's the most helpful podcast. My family and I went on a trip to Walt Disney World. Thankfully, I found WW Radio. Lou and the podcast friends are full of insight and expertise. Thanks to Lou, I feel like an expert already about the ways to have fun and to organize our schedule. Thank you for all of your help. Thank you for taking the time to listen and be part of the family. To rate and review the show, visit iTunes or just go to www.radio.com/iTunes. There you'll find a link and instructions on exactly how to do it. And finally, and most importantly, I want to thank you. You give me the greatest gift of all, which is your time and the ability to share my love and my passion for Disney with you through the show and through so many other different ways. And if there's anything that I can help you in order to turn what you love into what you do, please, by all means, let me know. But remember, you know, things like this take sacrifice and they take risk. And you have to ask yourself, how much, you know, are you willing to risk? A very obscure quote from Tron Legacy is, you know, some things are worth the risk. And if it's something that you love and it's something that you believe in, it is absolutely something that you can and should take a chance on, because you never know what might happen as a result of it. And as a wise man once said, always keep moving forward. I hope that you have your best week ever. So until next time, see ya.
Hey Lou, it's Brian, Teddy, and Danielle from Long Island, New York. Just calling to say congrats on 10 years. I've been listening to you, well, for maybe 6 of those 10, but certainly once we found you, been listening from the back podcast. Still not 100% caught up, but just thanks for everything that you do. You really enhance our trip every time we go, and keep Disney in our everyday lives. So can't thank you enough, and you're the best man, and we'll keep listening and tell all our friends. Take care. Bye.
Good afternoon, Lou Mangiello. It's Gabby from Columbia, Maryland. Just calling to say that tomorrow I'm actually running the Cherry Blossom 10-miler. And typically when I'm listening to your podcast, it's usually while I'm driving to and from work or when I'm running. And I noticed today as I was kind of prepping my playlist for tomorrow is that I have listened through all of my current podcasts. So I decided to go back to the beginning of WDW Radio and I just listened to episode 1. So I'm very excited to see and to kind of like experience by listening how Walt Disney World has gone through so many changes since the show started and just kind of see how the show developed. So I'm eager to start listening some more and I'm excited to say that in just about, I think 18 days exactly, we'll be flying down to run the Dark Side 10K and half marathon in Walt Disney World, and hopefully I'll be able to see you and some other of the WDW Radio running team that weekend. So everyone have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you later, Lou. Bye.
Hi, Lou. My name's Stephanie Cooper. I am a brand new listener to WDW Radio, and I've been catching up on some older episodes, and the two that I've listened to the most recently are the funniest attractions, and then I listen to the Pirates of the Caribbean because that's one of my favorite rides. So I'm going to leave you my funny story, even though I know that it's a little bit too late. Thought you might enjoy it. I had ridden Pirates of the Caribbean, gosh, we probably rode it 4 or 5 times on my first visit. On my second visit, we rode it several times because I was pregnant and couldn't ride anything else. And on my third visit, I had my 2-year-old son with me and my father-in-law. And I had been trying to tell my very cautious 2-year-old, it's not scary. It's not a scary ride. We'll close your eyes if we need to. It's not a scary ride. It's not a scary ride. I don't know how often this happens, but just as we were coming into the battle scene, I don't know if there is somebody behind there controlling, if it's random, but just as we were coming by the cannons, I got shot in the face with the air cannon and screamed loudly, scaring my 2-year-old. He would not go on it again for the rest of the trip, but I've been on it probably at this point, because I'm still young and poor, probably over a dozen times now. It's the only time it's ever happened to me, and I haven't heard of it happening to anybody else. But that was one of the funniest moments for us. I don't think we stopped laughing until we were getting off the ride, and then we were sad that we had missed the ride from laughing the whole time. So anyway, that's my funniest attraction moment. Thank you. Love the show. Congratulations on the 10 years. Bye.
Hi, Lou. This is Sam from Westminster, Colorado. I've been a listener of the podcast for about a year and a half now, and I love it. I haven't been able to get to Disney World in a little while, but I'm very excited to be going back for Wine and Dine Race Weekend in November with my family. And I just finished your cast member episode. You asked everybody to tell you what cast member role they would love to be. And as great as it would be to be a friend of any of the characters, especially Mickey Mouse, my dream role would be to either run the Expedition Everest or be a driver for Kilimanjaro Safari. It just sounds so fun, and I love Animal Kingdom so much. Have a good day. Thanks. You've got a friend in me.
Yeah. End of line.